All right. Last week we were talking about the great judgment scene and said a lot about that. Not going to revisit all that except to finish up verse 14 and 15. Death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. Why do you suppose that is? Obviously, they are not literal entities. This is figurative, but symbolic or figurative as it might be, it still points to a real truth. So why do you suppose this is? Anyone have anything to offer on that? Ken?
Obvious comment that there's no longer any use for death and Hades. No one will be
right.
Physically dying.
Yeah. So it's very much like Earth itself or the physical system. It's going to be destroyed. Death and Hades are going to be destroyed. There's no longer any, as you said, rightly, no longer any need for them. People aren't going to be going into the Hadean world and, you know, dying a physical death any longer. All that's done. Okay, so that's really telling here. It's very, it manifests here what is happening, that we're reaching the end, as our script here, the divine script tells us here, we're reaching the end of the physical system. Not just as we know it, but the end of the physical system. It's not going to be regenerated or rejuvenated or reconstructed in any way. It's going to be just over. Okay? John? Death represents what happens to the physical body. Hades represents simply the realm of the dead. It's just the grave, if you will. While death happens to the physical person, the grave is what happens to them after that, if you will. So death and Hades together represent the ultimate end of every physical person. And keep in mind, as we'll visit in chapter 22, that this is all part of the curse that God put upon the world because of sin. So all this is due to sin. In fact, this whole judgment scene is because of sin. Everything we're reading in here is because of sin. And I stress that because if it weren't for sin, there would be no need for condemnation. There would be no need for judgment because there would be no condemnation. There would be no death because we would all live forever because there would be no condemnation. And there would be no curse because of that condemnation. You see what I'm saying? Everything hinges on or comes back to the fact that sin is in the world, has to be dealt with. Finally, there is a finality to this dealing with sin. And that's what we're seeing right here.
I know that some link Hades and the lake of fire together as if they're there. Well, and if Hades is going away, well, then the lake of fire must only be temporary. Now, that's eternal. And this verse here makes that very clear. If those are being thrown in it, it's not going away.
Right, right. Right.
And it exists forever.
Well, and to throw these two things, death and Hades, into the fire, remember what the fire is for. It's not just for destruction. It's for punishment, or it's for, you know, and it's not for purging either. It's not like purgatory. It's for you know, an ongoing punishment. Not that death and Hades are real entities or real persons of any sort and being punished in that sense, but the idea here is that they join in that punishment that is the result of sin. Satan is in hell because, or will be in hell because of sin. All the angels that follow Satan will be there because of their sin. Death and Hades are part of that sin that people experience. And therefore, those components, if you will also be cast into hell. And then finally, verse 15, anyone's name was not found written in the book of life. He was thrown into that lake of fire. Now we have the finality of all sinners. So we have the inciter to sin, the one who incites sin, the tempter himself, Satan, and all of his, can't use word minions anymore because, again, Pixar has, or whatever, has stolen that. But Satan and all his demons have are being destroyed. They have tempted humankind with sin. I'm not saying that they're the sole source of temptation, because our real temptation is within. Remember, that's what James says. But they do influence us to sin. They are going to be cast away. The false prophet, the beast, they're cast away. Death and Hades are cast away. And now all sinners are cast away. Who is left? Who is not cast into this fire? Christians. Okay? And by the way, faithful Christians. Because there will be pseudo-Christians, false Christians, or faithless Christians, or simply people who thought they were Christians but really weren't. They also will be joining those of the sinners, because their names will not be written in the book of life because of their disingenuousness, or because of their faithlessness, or because of their simply not having been converted in the first place. So all you have left after all these beings and entities, persons and elements of that are going back to that realm of sin, all those are destroyed. The only thing you have left now is the church. And that's exactly where this goes after this. In chapter 21, what do we see? The New Jerusalem. And God's care for the New Jerusalem. Because all the other things are gone. Nate? It can be used to purify or destroy. Or judge. I mean, in essence, those three things. You know, purify, to refine. 1 Peter 1, verse 6 through 9 talks about us going through, our faith going through a fire. That's for purification or refinement. We also see fire being used as a means of judgment. We also see fire being used as a means of destruction. Okay? So fire can be used in different ways. Just like water can be used in different ways. Water can be used to save or to destroy. Right? As it has been in the days of Noah. It saved Noah and his family, but it destroyed everything and everyone else. And Peter talks to that effect in 2 Peter 3. Okay, let's move on to better things here. I did want to touch on that, though, that we do need to see the finality here. And that there's no third option. There's no creating a customized end that is outside of what God says will happen. You're either going to be in this group, or you're going to be in this much larger group. But there is no third group. You can't just opt out of the system. Like, yeah, I don't think so. I'm going to exempt myself. I don't want to go to heaven, but I don't want to go to hell either. So I'm just going to float, you know, or whatever. There is none of that. No one has the authority to do that. As I've said many times, and it's relevant here again, the only decision-making power you have over your future is happening right here on this earth. After you're done here, there will be no decision-making on your part, at least not with respect to your moral future or your moral responsibility or your spiritual future. We could say it that way. Jim? Yes, so Rome had to be dealt with for the seven churches' sake. That had to be dealt with. But what Jesus is doing now in revealing these things to John is showing beyond that. And this is all in the indeterminate, non-specific future. In other words, it's in the future, but we don't know when. We don't have details as to when. He's just opening this curtain here and saying, well, and after Rome is destroyed, and after everything has run its course, Rome and everything of Satan, even after Satan is released and then does what he does, after all that, there's still this other chapter. And that's where we're at right now in Revelation, is in this final chapter of events, or final chapter of our existence. Okay, so by this time, when we're in chapter 21, chronologically speaking, or sequentially speaking, we are only dealing with God and His people. There is no one else. And His people will not coexist with sinners any longer because sinners are removed from the picture. They will not be tempted by Satan any longer because Satan is removed from the picture. They will not bear the curse of sin anymore because the curse is over, because that all had to deal with the physical system. That's where the curse was or is for our purpose here. The curse is here. We are in the curse or under the curse. We feel the effects of the curse. Every time one of our friends or loved ones dies, we experience the curse through them. We see it happening. And when we face our own mortality, we will be experiencing it personally. That's part of that curse, is that death that we spoke of. And what is that all about? Where did that all come from? Adam? Yes, Adam, but more specifically, sin. It's all because of sin. See, the modern world wants to etch sin out of our vernacular, out of our thinking, out of everyone's belief system. And God keeps coming back and saying, sin is the problem with everyone. And so here we are in full denial of our real problem and not therefore dealing rightly with the real problem, or dealing with the problem as though it were something less or something different than what God says the problem is. Would you agree? So the world says that the problem is an inequity of, or in, a need for reallocation of resources. Everyone needs to be given things. Or we have drugs and alcohol, or we have border crises, or we have mental health issues, or we have just generally health issues, or we have coronavirus, or this is what the world's focusing on as our problem. The implication is, if we could get rid of all those little problems, or big problems as you might see them, if we could get rid of all those things, then the world would be a great place to live. That's what the world is teaching. That's what it really believes. And God comes back and says, you're never going to live in peace and serenity and the kind of completeness you're looking for, because you are failing to deal with the real problem, and the real problem is spiritual in nature, not something else. I'm not saying these other things aren't problems. They are. But the real problem, the foremost problem, and the most devastating problem is sin. You agree with that? So, why do we talk about salvation and the gospel and Christian responsibilities, and as we've been in our lesson here, Christian relationships? Why do we talk about that all the time? It's because we're trying to overcome and counter the effects, the debilitating effects of our sins and just sin generally. It's not because we're just trying to grow a church and have religion and, you know, have good Bible studies, although all that can be part of the benefits of the process, but the real thing we're after here is to deal with sin rightly, to be honest about it, to be forthright about it, okay? Because the Bible is telling you, I mean, just what we went through, and it was an ugly picture here. This judgment scene is terrifying in some respects, because we are all going to stand before God someday. And what are we going to be giving account of? What have we did in the body? What's that have to do with? Well, whether we sinned or whether we were righteous. And whether our sins were taken care of through the blood of Christ or whether they weren't taken care of at all. And then, therefore, whether we're in the book of life or whether we're not in the book of life. That's what it all comes down to. So it's a serious thing. You want to be very prepared for this. Make sense? Okay. Now that I have your attention, okay. Anyway, Lori, what you have?
You were saying that people nowadays are trying to eradicate the sin from the
world. Yeah, it reminds me of that verse too. It's a great verse to go to, as God said, 700 years before Christ, that that's what people are going to do. And they were doing it in Isaiah's day, and they were doing it in Jesus' day, and they've been doing it for the every 2,000 years since then, and they're still doing it today. You know, truth is lies, and lies are truth. Light is darkness, and darkness is light. It just doesn't work that way. Can't. That was Isaiah 5:20 and 21 there. Okay, let's move on. Chapter 21, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth. So God is going to create a new physical system upon which to live our lives on a new earth. So he's going to destroy this one, but he's going to build a new one, right? No, he is not, okay? A new heaven and a new earth in this context, in this visionary context, is symbolic of a new dwelling place for God's people. A new dwelling place. The old dwelling place, the first heaven and earth, the old system is gone. It's done away with. Right? Okay, so as I mentioned before, our some of our other denominational friends believe that God is just going to purify this earth, purge it with fire, etc. However, it ends up being, and then put us all back here, except for, if you follow premillennialism, the 144,000 special people are going to reign with God in his heaven. The rest of us are going to be stuck here on this earth again for all eternity, right? Even though it's going to be a nice place, but we're still going to be here, and we're just going to live here forever and ever on earth, here on this physical system, okay? Even though this is all telling us that all that is not going to happen. There's no longer any earth. There's no longer any sea. The new heaven and new earth refers to, again, a new dwelling place for God's people. And that's when he says in verse 2, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. Have we seen this bride imagery before in Revelation? The answer is yes. We look back in chapter 19, verse 7. Let us rejoice and be glad, give glory to him, for the marriage of the Lamb has come and his bride has made herself ready. We've already seen this bride image in this same book, and that bride is the church. It is not a church building. It is not a group of churches. It is not an assemblage of denominational faiths or systems all put together in one body, because that's counterproductive, contradictory, and just doesn't make sense at all. And then, of course, to clothe herself in fine linen, and the fine linen, John says, remember he steps aside here and tells you what the fine linen is, it's the righteous acts of the saints, which tells you who the bride is. The bride is not a city, the bride is not a church system, the bride is the people, Christians, again, faithful Christians. Because all the unfaithful Christians are not going to be part of this scenario. So this new Jerusalem, why do you suppose he's using the name Jerusalem? Is there a connection here?
Well, for thousands of years, it was the center for worshiping God.
Right. So there's that.
Well, I was going to say, the temple was there. That was the main, that's where God was to be.
Right.
That Jerusalem has become the church.
Right.
And that's where everybody focuses now. So this new one is going to be the collection of all of those.
Yeah, it's going to be the new Jerusalem in the very real sense of the new place of worship, the new identity of God's people, and the new place where God is. Right. Right. Well, and this group, this new Jerusalem, isn't just those who are alive when Jesus comes, but those who have died in the Lord as well. I mean, these are people who have died in the Lord or died faithful through all of history, have been brought into this new Jerusalem. And it's coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband, as we said. This coming out of heaven doesn't mean that it's leaving heaven to come back to earth, which is, again, where the premillennialists go. The imagery here is that this whole concept of the New Jerusalem is from God. He's the one that came up with it. He's the one who made it happen. He's the one who's making all the decisions regarding it. So it comes from God. Just like we say about Scripture, that this is divinely revealed information. It comes from God. It is God-breathed, which doesn't make the Bible, the words on the page, some kind of having magical properties. It tells us of where it came from. The origin of this information is of God. That's what this is saying here. And then, of course, that made ready as a bride, adorned for her husband, does speak to this unity here of Christ and his church. I want to say something about that, but first I want to say, in God, in creating a new existence, a new place, a new dwelling place, God, as an all-powerful being, unlimited in creativity, just think about that. You have all power, all intelligence, and unlimited creativity. Could God make 1,000 different worlds like ours, each one different, with different dynamics and different physics and different elements and so on? Could he do that? Nothing stopping him. I'm not saying he's done that. I'm saying he could if he wanted to, because he has all the resources and the ability to do so. So to destroy this system and create a new one, a better one, superior to this one in every way, is nothing for a God who has all power, all intelligence or all knowledge, and all creative ability. It's nothing for him to do that. So we want to think about that, that this is an entirely new world, not founded upon natural laws or natural physics that we are used to in the first world or in the world that we're presently living in. I wanted to take you just briefly to 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul speaks to this kind of indirectly. He speaks to the same thing, but he talks about this, and as you see on the screen, he talks about the spiritual is not first, but the natural, then the spiritual. Now, he's talking about a human body here. You can't have a spiritual glorified body in heaven unless, of course, first of all, you have an earthly physical body here on earth. That's what he's saying here. The first man is from the earth, earthy. The second man is from heaven. In other words, he's not talking about Adam and Christ here. He's really talking about the origin or the type or the nature of every single human being. The first go-around, our first existence, is here in the earth or on the earth. Okay? Our second existence, or the continuation of our spiritual existence, you might say, is not here. It is in heaven. It is spiritual in nature. Does that make sense? That's what Paul is saying here. As is the earthly, verse 48, so also are those who are earthy. In other words, you expect earthy or earthly beings to conform to and to dwell upon an earthly existence or context. That makes sense, right? It's like a fish that is made for water. Where is it most naturally to be found? In water, because it's made for that. Water is its habitat. Now, if fish were able to get out of the water and live on land, well, then that would be a different kind of existence. By the way, that's what evolution teaches, right? You've all seen the old textbooks in high school. The fish climbed out of the sea and grew limbs and then turned into a dinosaur and so on, right? Because that's all factual, because people were there to watch that. And then they drew pictures while they were doing it, and then they put them in textbooks. That's how that happened. You didn't know that, but that's what happened. Okay, anyway, so but this is what we're talking about. And so just as we, verse 49, once again, talking about people, just as we have borne the image of the earthy, we will also bear the image of the heavenly. Okay, again, Paul is talking about people. He's talking about all people. He's talking about everyone who's been born of flesh and blood, who lives on this earth, and then dies, and then goes into a spiritual existence. What John is talking about, or what John is seeing, and then relaying to the rest of us, is the same thing, but not talking about any specific person, but now talking about the church itself. Because if you think about it, the church begins here on earth, doesn't it? Right? We are the church. I don't mean just us, but we are the church, and the church begins on earth. And that 144,000 that we saw back in chapter 14 on Mount Zion, that's all on earth. That's what that's referring to. Now we're looking beyond that. Because the earth is gone, and our earthly existence is gone, we're beyond that at this point in Revelation. And so now we can look into what's going to happen to us, what's going to happen specifically with God's people in the future. And that's what he's telling us here. Comments or questions? All right, so that's what's happening there. This is one of the greatest passages in the Bible, in my opinion. These next few verses, I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them. And they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And he will wipe every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away." Remember, the earth has passed away. The sea has passed away. The heavens, the cosmos, have passed away. All earthly existence has passed away. And therefore, all the remnants of earthly existence, including the curse itself that was negatively affecting the earth ever since Adam sinned, that also has passed away because it's been fulfilled. Either the curse is carried out in the ravages of those who are cast into the outer darkness, or it is fulfilled in Christ who died for his church. He fulfilled in himself that curse. He took that curse upon himself on the cross. And so there's no longer a need for that curse. It's not a lingering problem. It's not something that has to still be dealt with. Those things have passed away. Verse 5, "And he who sits on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' And he said, 'Write, for these words are faithful and true.'" In other words, this is not a guess. This is not an opinion. These are facts about what is going to happen. God is not assuming anything. He is not pretending anything. He's promising things. These are promises that God is making here. So it's really powerful to see that that these promises made by God are going to be carried out. Okay, there's no reason for those things that he mentioned there in verse 4. The things of death, the tears, the mourning, the crying, the pain. There's no reason for those things anymore. Nobody will be dying anymore. There won't be any more separations. There won't be any having to leave people that you love and care for, because you'll be with those people forever. And there won't be any pain caused by sinners through oppression or abuse or neglect or trauma or anything like that, because all that is of the first system and all that has passed away. So all the damage, in essence, all the loss, all the corruption that sin has brought to us in our world right now, because we all feel that damage. And if we're honest with ourselves, we have even contributed to that damage ourselves. All that damage and loss and corruption is going to be all done away with. Not only is the damage itself going to go away, but the context in which that damage was done, which is the physical realm, is also going to be done away with. That's what we're seeing here. So that means there's no other context in which those things can happen again. These are good things, right? I mean, this is where our minds should go anytime we're feeling overwhelmed or feeling down about the way of the world and losses, feeling sorry for ourselves, and rightly so, for losses we incur in this life or the death of loved ones. I mean, these are hard things to deal with. But where we should go ultimately, looking past all that, and not trivializing those things on the way, but looking past all that, we should be going to this passage right here. Behold, I make all things new. That's what God is saying here. One other thing we see here in God saying all this, and this goes right into verse 6, it is done. Okay, I'm the Alpha and the Omega. I'm the beginning and the end. Whatever God begins, I should do it this way for you guys. Whatever God begins, he also ends. Right? Whatever God starts, he also finishes. Whatever God promises, he also fulfills. Whatever God says, something's going to happen. God doesn't do things or say things or promise things or start things without finalizing them and showing you is really what is going on here. He is showing you the script, so to speak, of how things are all going to play out. And therefore, everything that he brought into existence in the creation in Genesis 1, he's showing you how that's all going to be wrapped up and then some. In other words, that's going to be taken care of and done away with, and here we begin the new existence. And there is no end to that because that existence has no end because now we're with God. We're no longer in a context where we have beginnings and endings, so to speak. We just have a beginning without an ending. And that's really how we should look at eternity. It's just a beginning without an ending. It's not how many years or how many millennia or anything like that. It's just a beginning without an ending. Because that's how God operates in his world. It's good stuff here. Nita.
And this is what Jesus promised his apostles when he was getting ready to leave them in John 14.
Right. That's what he said, and verse 3, where I will come again to receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be. And of course, Thomas has to say, well, we don't know where you're going, right? Thomas! Of course, I would have been that guy, right? I mean, seriously, any of us could have been that person if we were there. I mean, we beat up on Thomas for being doubting, and yet we have our doubts too, don't we? Sometimes, right? So we're just being human when we do that. But anyway, Jesus says, don't worry about it. I am the way, I'm the truth, I'm the life. Follow me, you're going to be okay. Sure. That's right. Yeah. And we do the same thing sometimes. No, that's him. That's in Hebrews 3. Was it verse 1 there? That's what the Hebrew writer says of Jesus, that he's the apostle and high priest of our confession. Hebrews 12 says that he is the author and perfecter of our faith. So both of those elements there. 12 verse 2. Okay, so the Hebrew writer has a lot to say about Jesus, as you can imagine. All right, let's get back to Revelation 21 and say something about, before we leave it behind too far, that bride being adorned for her husband. The thing I wanted to say about that is, first of all, the church is portrayed as a bride elsewhere outside of Revelation. I give you a couple passages. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 2, Ephesians chapter 5 in particular, verse 25 through 27. We should not impose our understanding of earthly marriage on this marriage between Christ and his church. Really, what's being brought out is not what are they going to do together, but rather the concept of marriage itself. And really, in the most basic form, what is marriage? It's a union. I'm sorry, I almost went to Princess Bride. I have it in my briefcase. Marriage. How's it go? I can't remember. It brings us together today. So if you've ever not seen Princess Bride, that scene is worth the whole movie right there. So anyway, but marriage is, it's all about a union. It's a union of two separate people who are brought together in really a holy matrimony, as we often say, a holy union. One that is created by God, given to us by God, and is also enforced, if you will, by God. That's what Jesus says. What God has put together, let no man separate or put asunder, right? So the idea of marriage is to be a union, and it's to be a permanent union. We look at marriage on the earthly in the earthly context, of course, as limited to human life, and rightly so, because once your spouse is dead or you are dead, then the other party cannot sustain that union any longer. The union's broken by death. Paul talks about that in Romans chapter 7, verse 1 through 3, by the way. Okay, death separates or ends that earthly union of marriage. But this marriage, this union, this sacred, holy union, is not going to be ended by death or any kind of separation, because there will be no death or separation. It will be never ending. It will have a beginning and then no end. It will begin as a celebration, but the celebration over this union will have no end. It's like we'll have a wedding celebration for Christ and his church forever. And we are the church, if indeed we are faithful to him and continue into that spiritual context there. All right, so this is something really important to see here. It is an eternal union, one pronounced by God himself. The bride is going to be forever with this groom, Christ, ever forever protected by him and forever provided for by him. I know I used two prepositions in a row there. You're not supposed to do that, but I did. Okay? So the provision is made for the church perpetually through Christ. Does that make sense? So we're looking at the concept of marriage being carried out in this ultimate context, which is in the spiritual realm. Behold, I make all things new. I wanted to say something about that back in the book of Hebrews, chapter 10 and verse 9. Jesus is talking in one of the messianic prophecies here that's being cited. Behold, I have come to do your will. And then the writer says of Christ, he takes away the first in order to establish the second. Now, that's a principle there. That's a biblical principle that extends well beyond what it's talking about or being used for here. Because here in Hebrews, he's talking about what? Someone whispered it, I think. Covenant. He's talking about the covenant. He's talking about the first covenant being fulfilled so that the second covenant can be inaugurated, if you will, or can begin. He, Jesus, takes away the first covenant in order to establish the second covenant. That's what he's talking about. All right, so that's what he's talking about there. But as a principle, this is applicable to our present situation in the book of Revelation 21. Because the first has to be taken away in order for the second to be established. And once again, I go back to the physical system has to be taken away in order for the spiritual system to take its place. So they're not co-reigning. There's not a coexistence of the two. Right now, so to speak, we have a coexistence of the two, even though we can't see the second one. But we have a coexistence because we have two different realms, an earthly realm and a spiritual realm that we're not yet part of. But once we are all in the spiritual realm, this first system will have to be taken away. There's another verse here that is worthy of our attention in Hebrews, and that is Hebrews chapter 8, the very last verse, when he talks about, again, the covenant. He has made the first obsolete by talking about a new covenant. But whatever is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to disappear. This earthly system is getting old and becoming obsolete and is ready to disappear. Just wanted to reinforce the principles of those ideas before we move past those. Any comments or questions on that? Phil, did you have a comment? Yes. Yeah, we are in a covenant relationship with God. And keep in mind, too, though, that the whole reason for covenant is what? John? It does have promises in the covenant, but why do we have a covenant? Why do we need a covenant at all? Will? You are right. That's what covenant is. So you're talking about the promises of the covenant, what covenant is. You guys are overthinking this. You're making it too hard. But I'm impressed because you are talking accurately about what covenant is and what it does. What's the reason for covenant? Okay. So if the covenant is for salvation, what are we being saved from? What are we being saved for? Why are we being saved? Thank you. That's the reason for covenant. It's sin, once again. If you think about it, logically, the only reason why we need to have two parties be brought together that were alienated from each other, that need to be reconciled through covenant, the only reason we have to have them reconciled is because they were unreconciled or non-friends, right? Made enemies because of something in the way. That's what Paul talks about in Romans 5, verse 6 through 10. We were enemies of God, and we were therefore helpless, and therefore hopeless, and hostile to God even, because of our sin. And through Christ, we are reconciled with God in covenant, in this covenant relationship, but the reason for the covenant is because of sin. If there had never been any sin, we would never need a covenant. Right? Nobody thinks about this stuff, but Chad, apparently. I don't know. I actually have done a lot of thinking on this. And you think about, because sometimes people say, well, when we're in heaven, then the grace of God will be there to, it's like there won't be any grace. There won't be any need for grace because we won't be in a covenant relationship with God there. Will we? Because there won't be any sin to have to bring us together in that covenant relationship. We will be with God, and God will be right there in our midst. We will have one-to-one, face-to-face, person-to-person relationship with God, and nothing will come between that. And there will be no need for covenant, and there'll be no need for reconciling, and there'll be no need for grace, because grace is all about sin, too. And forgiveness is all about sin, too. And most of the elements that we see about salvation all come back to, not promises, but first of all, dealing with sin. But then, yes, as John rightly said, promises too. Promises about a better future. So this covenant that Israel had with God was fulfilled in Christ, and Christ began a new covenant. When will that covenant be fulfilled? When, what we're reading right now, when Christ's church enters into glory, that covenant will be fulfilled, because that's what this covenant we're in right now promises us. And then it will be done. And that's why he says here in verse 6, it is done. What did Jesus say on the cross? Some of his final words? It is finished. It is done. The work is done. Whatever God starts, he finishes. Whatever he begins, he ends. He's the Alpha and the Omega. He's the A and the Z. Okay? So we want to see that. We don't have a dangling, open-ended covenant thing going on into eternity. We don't have that. It's going to be fulfilled. And we're even told here how it will be fulfilled and when it will be fulfilled. Not what year or what time, but chronologically or sequentially, we know when it will be fulfilled after these other things have run their course. All right, John. Okay, say that again. Yes. It'll be like that in principle, but better. Because even then, they weren't in God's world. They were, God was coming into their world. But we will be in God's world with God. And he will be, as he says here, amongst us. That's what he just said here in verse 3. He will dwell among them. They shall be his people. Have we heard that phrase before? We shall be his people and he will be our God. I keep telling you, and it's true, that this is the theme of the entire Bible, right there. That is the theme of the Bible, that's what God is after. That will be the summation of all things right there, is when God is God over all of his people who are not cast into the outer darkness. Everyone who is left, God will be their God and they will be his people forever. That's how that's going to play out. And so now we can look forward to that. Behold, I'm making all things new. He doesn't say I'm refurbishing everything. He doesn't say I'm rejuvenating everything. He doesn't say that I'm going to fix up all the problems of the old system, put a new can of spray paint on everything and, you know, a little bit of Bondo and we'll get this jalopy working again, right? He doesn't say any of that. He's saying, I'm just starting over. We're going to make all things brand new here. Kimberly?
I'm just always wondering, you know, that you hear that where we will. I guess my question is, do you think we, God, will look like we look?
I don't know.
Because we're supposed to be in his image.
Yes. But that imagery isn't physical as much as it is bearing the attributes, if you will, of God. Intelligence, emotions, personality, identity, and so on. But does God have five fingers on each hand? Does he have hands at all? I don't know. I seriously doubt it. But what does he have better than that, in my opinion? I can't conceive of better than that, but better than that. Because remember, he's all intelligent, all powerful, not lacking in any creativity. So whatever he makes is going to be, if I can say it this way, less than what he is himself. In other words, he's not going to be a part of what he makes. He's going to be better than all of that. But he's going to be including his creation with his existence with his home there. Hope that makes sense. I know some of this is kind of heavy stuff. It'll leave you laying awake at night thinking about it. Not in a bad way, by the way, but in a good way. Okay, Nita? Yeah. Right. We will be better because all the things that keep us from being better here will be removed. And then all of the power that God has to bring us into conformity with his world will have been done. I mean, you think about passages like Philippians 3, verse 20, 21, our citizenship is in heaven. We wait, therefore, for Christ, the Savior. And what does he say? He will transform the body of our humble state, which is what we have right now, right? A humble body into conformity with the body of his glory. And, of course, he has the power to do that. One last verse, and we'll have to call it quits for tonight. But 1 John chapter 3, John says in verse 2, behold, we are children of God. It has not appeared as yet what we will be. In other words, when Jesus comes. We know that when he appears, we will be like him because we will see him just as he is. So even John is admitting, I don't know what we're going to look like, but we're going to be like Jesus, which is exactly what Paul just said, right? And in fact, Paul says it repeatedly throughout different letters, but we're going to be like Jesus. Well, what is Jesus like? Well, do you remember Jesus in the opening of Revelation in chapter 1? You remember that glorified, high priestly looking, angelic-like, but better than that, presence of Christ? If he's saying that we'll be like him, then that tells you something about what our future is going to look like, if indeed we stay faithful. That's pretty impressive. All right, we're going to stop here because, again, we're out of time and others have to speak here. So I hope that what we have talked about, though, let me get this right here, has been encouraging to you.